I would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Nat R. from Park City, Utah.
Hi, I'm Nat. I'm an alcoholic. I'm sober by the grace of God in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. My sobriety date is April 4th, 2004, and I just celebrated 14 years of sobriety. My sponsor a while back was Larry D. He was one of the founding members of this group and a longtime member of our fellowship here in San Diego. And his sobriety date was 112288. 112288. He used to say that that was the only thing that no one could take away from him. And I know that that's the only thing that no one can take away from me is 4404. We don't come up with these cool sobriety dates, I think, on purpose. I remember my first year of recovery, my friends in my home group would make fun of me, and they would say that if I relapsed, I could get sober again on Cinco de Mayo, which would have been, you know, 5505, like the following year, if you'd wanted to plan it that way. But what I can tell you is that I really believe that. No one can take that away from me. I'm the only one that can give it away or throw it away. And that's really important to me. I hope that your sobriety date is important to you, whatever that may be. And if you're not done yet, all I really have to say about that is go get done. It's all right with us. We'll still be here when you get back. So about, what is it, 2-3 days ago, I'm all discombobulated because I drove here. It's a 12-hour trip from Park City where I live, and I drove down here on Thursday. I went to the dentist on Friday, and I'm speaking here, and then I'll be home tomorrow. Tomorrow's the last day of skiing for those of us up there. We still have really good spring skiing, and I've been skiing about 2-3 times a week for the past couple of weeks, and I got in some good powder days this season, so I think it was, I skied on Tuesday, I skied on Wednesday, I drove on Thursday, went to the dentist on Friday, I'm speaking here on Saturday. So if I seem a little disoriented, please forgive me for that, just in advance. So what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. Anybody's story is going to have different elements in it. If you don't relate to my story, I would just say, you know, keep coming back till you hear somebody tell your story from the podium. I'll try very much to share in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, so that we can all best relate to that, I guess. I don't mind, you know, some head nods and some whatnot. I'll do my best to look around and acknowledge anybody who feels like there's something in my story that really relates to them or resonates with them. But what it was like was basically that I was drinking on a pretty much daily basis. I was divorced and living in my mother's basement for a time, and then living in a house where I didn't have to pay rent for a time. It wasn't a very nice house, but I was able to conduct myself with honor on the outside. So if you didn't really know what my inside life looked like, my emotional life, or even get very close to me, when I showed up for work and kind of put on the whole thing with the, you know, and the nails and the clothes and the shoes and all that, I looked pretty good on the outside. In fact, to some people, I kind of looked like I was at the top of my game. And I was kind of making the money and having the stuff that goes along with that kind of life. And, you know, but morally and spiritually and emotionally, I was feeling like things were more and more wrong with me. And it was taking more and more drinking to kind of keep the juggling act going. And I was pretty mortified. I was pretty mortified that my life was the way that it was. And I was running out of excuses. And when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I thought an alcoholic was like a homeless bum, living under a bridge trestle, you know, trench coat, flashing little girls on the playground, or someone like my father who, beat his wife, beat his kids, never really had the same job, but seemed to always have a job, but could never really bring home a paycheck. And that's what I thought an alcoholic was. And I thought that if you lived like I lived, for example, I was the only 26-year-old that I knew that had a line item in her budget for $400 worth of alcohol, et cetera, per week. So that's how I roll. If you want to party with me, you know. And I just thought, you know, all the dinner parties and the, you know, the top shelf stuff and the clinky glasses and all of that, if I could just keep that going, then clearly I couldn't be an alcoholic. I wasn't an alcoholic. And so I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, more or less devastated with all the internal stuff that's going on. And it was getting harder and harder and harder to keep up that facade. And I remember one of those first meetings I went to, they went around the room and the format of the meeting was, hi, my name is, I'm an alcoholic, my sobriety date is, and my day was such and such. And I remember they got to me and I said, hi, my name is Nat and I need to be here. I didn't say I was an alcoholic. And there were these sober bikers that were all lined up, in chairs against the one wall. And, the meeting was just full of roughnecks, and the sober bikers did this bobblehead thing, like, yes, you do, you know. Because I believe that alcoholics, we can see through all that. You know, that's kind of my point. I believe that we see each other, almost like I can pick you out of a crowd. So that started my journey with Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not understand that Alcoholics Anonymous had a solution for permanent recovery. I did not understand that what I get here is to be recovered, past tense, ED, recovered. I did not understand that there was permanent victory over alcohol. I thought it was some place to hang out on a Saturday night in a church basement, what have you. Where I don't want to drink today. Let me go find some sort of social club. That's what I thought it was. Now, what kept me in Alcoholics Anonymous were a few things. There were hot guys. They looked really sexy with their clothes off. People said interesting things. And I was able to start to listen. Where I got sober, it was very much a sit down, shut up, take the cotton out of your ears, put it in your mouth. If you had less than 90 days sober, you weren't allowed to share in a meeting because you didn't have any solution that we wanted to hear about. And you were kind of I was like the mascot of my home group. So they kind of like toted me around to different meetings. And there were newcomer meetings in my area where I got sober in New York, and they would kind of take your home group would kind of take you to those meetings, and you were allowed to share as a newcomer in those meetings. And so when I remember being a little bit less than 30 days sober, and I was absolutely terrified. When they said that I should be a member of that home group. And I didn't know what that meant, but I really, really wanted to stay sober. And this is what I'm trying to impress upon you or share about my experience, that, the details of drinking, I hope I don't need to go into too much of all of that, but I clearly qualified to be an Alcoholics Anonymous, but I had this sneaking suspicion that you wouldn't accept me. And I was hoping against hope that I was actually an alcoholic and I wasn't just like a crazy person, because the lunacy that was going on in my mind was that if I didn't truly belong here, then what I really deserved was to be removed from society, and I needed like a padded room and like a straitjacket, because that was like really how I felt on the inside. And and those people in my home group, they were doing was like just trying to get me to, come back. And they were sharing their experience with me, and I was relating to what they were saying, and I was listening. I was starting to listen, and they said that I need to be a member of that home group, and that's how people stayed sober, by being a member of the home group. And so, I was a hot young thing, and they were like, you need to tell us why you get to be a member of this home group, whatever. So, like, I prepare to, like, petition them for, like, why I need to be a member. And I prepare this speech. I show up at the business meeting. And And I didn't realize, like, the joke was on me. That's the point, you know. The joke was on me. Like, I get up there like, oh, you know, this and that. They're like, you're in. Sit down. You know, here's the key to the church. You're making the coffee, you know. My experience with Alcoholics Anonymous is, you know, back east, I don't know if we say it here, but back east they say I'm a one-chip wonder. You know, I came in, they told me that I never ever had to feel the way that I felt when I got here, that I never ever had to take another drink of alcohol. And that's what I desperately wanted. Like, I wanted to know how to not have to drink, because if you were me, you had to drink over the things that I had done. I had to drink over the things that I had done. I had to drink to forget, and I had to drink to feel numb. And so when they told me that, I believed them. Now, I managed to put together 30 days sober. I don't know how I did that. I really don't know how I did that, but I kept showing up, and I thought, oh, they gave me the key, and I got to make the coffees. Poor alcoholics, you're not going to have any coffee to drink if I don't show up to make it, you know. And but the point about all of that is that I got into service right away. And they're carrying me around to meetings. I got 30 days. I got 90 days. At about 9 months sober, I called my closest AA friend. That's what it says in the big book. It doesn't say sponsor. I've always had a sponsor. But my closest AA friend is a man named Fred W. And I had been, I had moved out of state at that point. And I had called my closest AA friend, and I just told him, I said, you know, it's New Year's, I don't think I'm going to make it. I had just gone through something that I thought was really traumatic, and I was feeling like, I don't know, is this what people drink over? You know, I was just feeling really on edge, something wasn't right, and I said, I don't think I'm going to make it. And he said, all right, Nat. He says, well, I'll talk to you tomorrow, or I'll see you tomorrow. I don't remember what he said, you know, like, I'll see you tomorrow. And I went to sleep that night sober, and I woke up the next morning sober. And about 11 o'clock that morning, I got a phone call, and he said, hey, can you come pick me up at the bus station? He had taken the Amtrak and the bus 5 states away so that I woke up with my best AA friend in my town. And that's how I was carried in Alcoholics Anonymous in the beginning. People shared their experience, strength, and hope with me. They told me drinking stories. They said some clever things. Later, as I got into the big book, I was like, oh, those really clever things they were saying, that's like right in there. you know, but they just carried me in the beginning. Nobody ever tried to get in my pants. Nobody ever treated me like, you know, that was my purpose in Alcoholics Anonymous. If I was eye candy, I certainly was looking at you like you were eye candy, if you were my deal. And I believe that God, I understood this then, and I understand it even better now. I believe that God will use, for this alcoholic, God will use what works. You know, have any kind of opinion about that you want. You know, when I kind of thought real, not very deeply, but when I started to think about the second step, I didn't put a label on it. I didn't want to have any discussions about it. I didn't want to know what your experience was or how it differed from mine or, you know, whether, you know, your theory or my theory were, like, academically sound. I remember running around at AA meetings in the grass looking for four-leaf clovers. And I thought that if I could find enough four-leaf clovers, that I could stay sober for that day. So I remember hedging my bets against that. Like at 90 days sober, I had at least 90 four-leaf clovers, you know? And so it was like, and I would find so many that I would give them out to other people in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, people had never seen them. And I don't know if that was the, you know, a God concept that I had, you know, that worked for me for a little bit or a long time or still does or whatever the story is, you know, I just don't know that it matters. And I remember, you know, with the third step and the first inventory that I did, you know, at that point I was living in Virginia Beach, Virginia, and I had met a woman who had 21 years of sobriety, and she had gotten sober at 25 years old, so I could kind of relate to that, you know, sort of imagine like, oh, someday I want to be in that place. And I remember thinking to myself, there was no way I could lie to a lady in a wheelchair. I can lie about a lot of things to a lot of people, but I couldn't lie to a lady in a wheelchair. That was enough. That was enough. You know, our book talks about, you know, personality change sufficient to overcome alcoholism. Sufficient, you know, that word enough. This lady, she was my sponsor. Her name was Robin. She's now since passed away a number of years ago, sober. And I remember being over at her house. You know, we had said the third step prayer together, and I had done this inventory, and I had brought it over to her house, and I was as honest and as thorough as I possibly could have been at that time. And we got to the end of that talk, and she said, "Nat, do you feel like you left anything out?" And I said, "No, Robin, I've told you everything." And I really did feel like it. You know, I'd unburdened myself of I'd done that first major house cleaning. And I had to unburden myself, and she had this little post-it note or whatever, and she had taken a few notes on it, just jotted a few things down, and she turned it around on the table, and she slid it across, and it had two names on there of stuff that she and I had talked about that hadn't been on my inventory, you know, and it was worth a good chuckle. My sponsorship has always been that honest and that thorough. You know, I need to know when I lay my head on the pillow at night that I have been that honest in my day. And, you know, if there's something for this alcoholic that I have left out, I have people that I will call in the middle of the night. And so that was the relationship I had with this woman. You know, fast forward a little bit, I got involved in, you know, young people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got pregnant, got married in that order, and moved to San Diego. And you know, really all I want to say, you know, about a few things about that is that, you know, when you kind of get into, you know, into the middle of the herd, you know, you don't want to fall out the edges. And so I was really doing the deal because, you know, I just really felt like, you know, a few things in my life were like not working out, you know, really well. And I just was having a tough time. And I, you know, I just started, you know, sponsoring a lot of people and going to a lot of meetings, and I was really involved with, you know, young people here. And at, you know, at some point I felt like I was like sponsoring like half of AA, and those things happened for me. You know, I did move around a little bit in sobriety and always stayed involved and always stayed in the book. And I've always had a sponsor. When I was about 2.5 years sober, my sister died of a drug overdose. And I ended up taking custody of my then 19-month-old nephew. And he just celebrated his 13th birthday. And you know, along the way, I divorced that fellow that I married in Alcoholics Anonymous. I realized that I was in an abusive relationship, and I was afraid to tell anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous about that, especially when you're sponsoring half of young people. You know, admitting that your ass is on fire is not the coolest thing, you know, to do. And again, I had great sponsorship during that period of time. And you know, I remember that my sponsor at the time had actually moved. She had been living in Point Loma, and she had moved up to L.A. for whatever reason, and my sister died, and all this stuff happened. And I approached Larry D. and asked him if he would be my sponsor, and he said, "Well, you know, let's have coffee and whatever, and we'll talk about it." And really, I mean, this was very selfish of me. I knew Larry. Larry knew me. We went to a couple of meetings together. He had, you know, he kind of knew me as much as, you know, a person that would share at meetings and kind of was up to speed on my life. And I didn't have time to just, like, pick a sponsor out of a hat and, like, train them up, you know, about what all my issues were. And so, you know, we had coffee the next night or a couple nights later. I don't really remember that part. And he admitted to me, so we were sitting down, and he said, "Nat, do you feel like there's anything that you can't tell me?" And I said, "No, Larry, there's nothing that I can't tell you." And he said, "Okay." He said, "Because if you even hesitated for a minute, or, you know, hesitated for a second, I was going to have to tell you that I can't be your sponsor." And he related to me, he said that when I had first asked him, he said, "You know, what's this little white girl want with an old black man like me?" You know, and I'll never forget that, because that man saved my life. You know, it was just in the midst of all this turmoil. And, you know, fast forward a little bit, you know, a little bit later, when I left that relationship, I was actually back in Virginia, and I was calling Larry on the phone, like, what do I do, what do I do, what do I do? And some really interesting things were happening in my life. I had received a spiritual calling. I'm not going to go into too much detail about that, but I was really very confused why it was that God had asked me to do certain things, and really did not feel very well equipped for that. I felt very uncomfortable. I felt, you know, like, why pick me? A lot of that kind of stuff, you know. And, you know, and I called him up, and you know, he just had a way of, like, handling things, you know, that were with analogies that, you know, I wouldn't have come up with. But, you know, just a lot of, you know, we talked about boxing a lot. We talked about, some sports analogies and things like that. And he would, you know, he just reminded me. He said, you know, move your feet, move your feet, move your feet, you know, like. And we also talked about, you know, keep your eye on the prize. And so with this calling that I had received, we kind of worked backwards. Like, well, what do you need to do in order to accomplish that? And what would that look like? And we just kind of, like, worked backwards. And I ended up, leaving my spouse and coming back to San Diego. My daughter, who at that time was almost 4 years old, he filed an injunction so that I couldn't remove her from the state. He felt that if he could basically, you know, keep her there, he could continue to torture me, and mama don't play. And so, but it was really hard. It was really hard. I was calling up women, in Alcoholics Anonymous here. I won't name names because, again, I promise to share in a general way, but I was calling up women, and I was just like, I'm such a failure. I can't believe I did this. I mean, I was just full of guilt and shame. And I didn't, you know, at the time that I left my husband, I thought to myself, either he's going to kill me, I'm going to kill myself, I'm going to get drunk, or, you know, I mean, it was a really bad situation. It was a very bad situation. And I remember thinking to myself, my daughter can grow up with a dead mom. My daughter can grow up with a drunk mom, or my daughter can grow up with a mom that lives in California. You know, and so it was like, I was calling up these women, and I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do, I don't know what I'm going to do. And they were like, you know what, you stay sober one day at a time, you make sure that she has a safe home to live in, you know. And so, and that's what I've always done. And these women said, like, hey, listen, you know, like, one day when she's 16 years old, she may call you from the bus station and say, like, hey, you know, I'm here. I figured out that dad's, like, a total douchebag, and, you know. And that's funny because actually she's 11 now and she's like a little spitfire. She's just like her mom and like her dad. And she may have some trials in life, but I fully believe that with, you know, and we're all still sober. That's the other part that I want to, you know, I want to say. She has two sober parents, and that's very important. So, you know, there's some things that have happened in sobriety that I've had to walk through, and I've never had to do it alone. I've always had a sponsor, a spiritual advisor, and, you know, and the fellowship around me. And I've learned to be able to tell on myself, you know, tell on myself. You know, there's a few things going on in my life right now. I live up in Park City, Utah. I own a home. I am recently experiencing some stress about, you know, selling my home, and can I get the money back out of it, and where do I want to go, and what do I want to do, you know. And what I keep doing is I just keep relying on a power greater than myself for those things. And, you know, and I have days where I'm really nervous. I've started dating recently, you know, practicing spiritual principles in dating, you know, is a new experience for me. I am going to finish a little bit early because I do feel a little bit nervous, and you know, but I will stick around a little bit after the meeting, you know, to speak with you guys about my experience. And I just want to let you know that I'm really, really grateful, one, to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, two, to stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and three, to have the pleasure of sharing a little bit of my life with you this evening. So thank you so much for letting me be here. Yeah.